Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. And we're going to talk about Senate Bill 55 here coming up this morning. We sat down with SDPB's Keely Boltina to talk about it. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB's education reporter Keely Boltina joins us today. We're going to talk about Senate Bill 55. It's an education bill that was approved by the state Senate last week, gaining a little bit of national attention. Opponents say it's anti-science. Proponents say it promotes academic freedom. Keely, welcome to In the Moment again.
Thank you.
Give us an overview of what the bill is, or maybe this one you can even read it to us because it's fairly short.
It is not a long one. The actual content of the bill is one full sentence. It says, "No teacher may be prohibited from helping students understand, analyze, critique, or review in an objective scientific manner the strengths and weaknesses of scientific information presented in courses being taught which are aligned with the content standards established pursuant to a law."
All right. What's it mean?
A lot of different people have a lot of different ideas on that. Proponents of the bill say that this allows teachers to bring in additional scientific theories that may be in conflict with the main one that they're being taught. For instance, the Big Bang, that there are other scientific theories that could account for the creation of the universe. And they want to make sure that teachers feel empowered to discuss that with their students. Opponents say that already happens. We allow that. We definitely encourage teachers to do that. It's written in the content standards and it's in practice. So we don't need a law like this. And they're concerned that it will bring in additional materials that are outside of the curriculum, which they think is a problem.
And that are unscientific is what they're concerned with.
Right. Because one of the problems that an opponent talked about with the bill is that in this language of objective scientific manner, there aren't definitions for objective or scientific. So what one person may consider real science, another may say that doesn't make sense, or that theory is flawed, or the way that they figured that out is wrong. And there's no way to filter that out. And the concept of having these understood portions of science is that lots of people agree on them and that, you know, they've been vetted appropriately.
So what are folks saying in peer about it?
One of the focuses is strengths and weaknesses. You heard that in the text of the bill itself. And the concept is, from the proponent side of Senate Bill 55, that the content standards right now provide for specific theories and then build around those theories. So we talked about the Big Bang. Proponent Senator Phil Johnson says that a theory like the Big Bang does have structure around scientific evidence. And the standards say we should allow competing ideas, but the standards don't actually present multiple theories. They present only the Big Bang theory. So he says that's true, too, with evolution, that we talk about Darwinian evolution. We don't talk about other theories of evolution. And that with climate change, we talk about that it is, you know, man-made. He doesn't talk about other theories of it. And he thinks that this bill allows those conversations to go beyond just the what is established as the theory. Opponents say that already happens. Opponents say that, sure, this is the agreed upon theory because it is this big consensus of people. And so we go with that and then we bring other theories in, but they're weaker. So we already talk about the strengths and weaknesses of the Big Bang. Nobody says this is exactly how it went. And we know that because everybody agrees nobody was around to see it.
Are we talking, when you talk about an alternative theory of evolution, are we talking about Genesis? When we talk about an alternative theory of the Big Bang, are we talking about the Bible here? Is this what they're saying should be allowed to be an alternate theory to the science curriculum?
Proponents of the bill say no is the answer to that question. They say that for things like the Big Bang theory or the theory of evolution, that there are other ways to explain that than just that particular one. They say we talk about evolution from Darwin, but there are other theories of evolution that are not a God created man. So those are the sort of theories that they point to as being what they want included in the discussions in the classroom. It gets murky. And we just talked about State Senator Phil Jensen. He had this interaction with Wade Pogany, who's with the Associated School Boards. And you can kind of hear how it's a little bit confusing. And they very much disagree over these 36 words.
You said religion can be brought in. I see this as only dealing with scientific information taught in class in courses that are aligned with the content standards. Now, where can religion slip into that?
if you take the content standards that deal with evolution, even Big Bang Theory, some of those, and if the teacher's views were allowed to be looking at analyzing various viewpoints of that, you would then have to take the opposite side of that, which could be a religious view of creationism. You could bring that into the discussion. And this bill clearly allows for that to happen.
So different people certainly think different things about what this really short bill does.
Do we have any scientists represented in the testimony last week?
The testimony included a scientist who opposes the measure. Rhea Waldman says that she's testifying as herself, and the reason she has concerns about this bill is that concept of not being able to understand what is objective and scientific to people. When she was asked about, shouldn't we respect all opinions in the classroom, her response was, opinions don't have a place in science. Mm-hmm.
The facts are there. So once you call something a scientific theory, I would rely on it. Otherwise, it's an hypothesis. If something is an hypothesis, it's still in the works and there are still disputes and we're not quite sure where it is at. Basically, every scientist can come up with an hypothesis. Once it gets into scientific theory, enough scientists have agreed on the evidence that as a scientist, I would say this is something you would believe in, you would put in a, you know, in a school book and teach other people because we are as sure as we can be right now, considering all the evidence, that this is a fact.
So that's one example of, I think her example she was looking at was the Big Bang Theory there, mm-hmm. where she's saying this is a group of scientists from all over doing all sorts of experiments and all sorts of thinking, and they agree on this. So it's the best explanation we have right now, and it's been, you know, run through many, many tests. So that's what we're going with until we have something different. And she's concerned other things don't follow that scientific process.
Which is how it made it into the curriculum in the first place.
Right.
Is the argument there.
Yes.
What are teachers saying about the bill?
State Senator Jeff Monroe is the prime sponsor of the bill. And he says he has talked with people in everyday life, but also teachers who say that they don't feel comfortable, they don't feel empowered to talk about things that are not creationism, that are still scientific theories, but that disagree with the main theory that is established in the education standards. He has two really specific examples of this.
I had one teacher, nameless, who showed the development, who would show how embryos develop, things like this, was told, knock it off. I had another one that expressed frustration at the fact that she was forced to teach previously global warming, now climate change, forced to teach that as a fact, and couldn't bring anything else in that she was forced, as someone who had conflict with that, to actually instruct the kids along that line in her classroom.
Another proponent of the measure is Brian Johnson. He testified in front of the committee. He's a parent from Rapid City. He also calls himself a science geek, and he has kids. So he's talking about this and looking into it. He says that he talked with teachers and said, if there's something that you know is scientifically based and it's not in the textbook, would you teach that anyway? And he says some teachers he talked to said, yeah, absolutely. It's based in science. I'm going to talk about that. That's what's important for a well-rounded discussion with the kids. And he said that wasn't the case with everybody.
I don't know. They squinted and they kind of cocked their head and they looked around. And eventually they'd say, you know, I don't think I would. I would ask why. Why not? I mean, it's science, right? And they were like, I really like my job. I love what I do. I don't think I'd take the chance. I just don't think I'd take the chance of being put under disciplinary action or a black mark on my record. And that was when it came back to me that we're all different.
And because we're different, he says that we have different ideas and should be able to explore those different realms. And then you get back into that cycle of, but are teachers already able to do that? And if we have content standards, is there a reason for that, which would be local control?
That is the next logical question, which is who gets to make this decision? Should it be peer?
The proponents of the bill say peer isn't making the decision, but rather allowing teachers to make the decision. State Senator Jeff Monroe calls this a citizen's bill because he points out that all of the opposition is from people he calls education professionals. He says his ideas don't really have traction with them right now, but these ideas are coming from people in the community. Now, the flip side of that is that some education professionals are concerned that we are going beyond the content standards and beyond what is acceptable for the curriculum that's decided at the state level. Mary McCorkle is the president of the South Dakota Education Association.
Is the bill about protecting teachers, or is it about expanding the curriculum beyond what a school district decides is the appropriate curriculum for its students? If it's about protecting teachers, those protections already exist. If it's about curriculum, those decisions belong at the local level.
And that local level concept is something that opponents kept talking about, even though proponents did too. It's this idea that you have a local school board, you have local teachers weighing in on curriculum, you have the opportunity as a parent or a member of the community to talk to them and to voice your concerns. And then that panel of people who live this every day is who is making the final decision in this. And it's underneath this overarching content standard that the state establishes so that we don't get a lot of extra theories in. Now, some people think extra theories are better, and even if they've been widely debunked, State Senator Ernie Otten says he looks at this bill and thinks, let's pass it. It's simple and it's good.
What about the flat earthers out there? What if you had somebody in there that was now teaching flat earth? How about not landing on the moon? And so as I started thinking about some of those things, then I started asking myself, well, really, what would be so bad about that? To have somebody actually challenge you for once in your life that what you're actually believing in is wrong.
The quest for making sure that we have as many ideas as possible that are real and that people can explore and that students can analyze and critique. Scientists, teachers say it still has to be within the realm of reality. So I don't know whether teaching students that there are alternative theories to
the moon landing,
I don't know that that's within a scientific standard that we have now. So people are trying to get at this idea that students should have personal freedom to explore and teachers should be able to talk about things without being muzzled. But they're doing it from such drastically different angles
right. That
they disagree on the real ramifications of Senate Bill 55.
So it reads like a simple bill, but there's a lot going on underneath the surface of it.
This is not the last time you'll hear about this.
All right, Keely Bultina, thanks for bringing it to us.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The Rapid City Police Department has released its crime statistics for 2016. Here to dig into the numbers is Police Chief Carl Jegras. Chief, welcome to In the Moment. Thank you.
Good morning, Lori.
Would you like to give us an overview of the 2016 crime stats? Let's start there.
Sure. So a couple of weeks ago, we did release our 2016 crime stats to the community. And we worked very hard to put that together as quickly as possible, and we had it out about 2 weeks after the new year. So in 2016, we saw about a 2.6% overall decrease in calls for service compared to the year prior, which, you know, that was important to us in that essentially our workload and crime in general had a slight reduction. But the thing about it is that 2.6% decrease was after a record-breaking year. So clearly we have our work cut out for us. So, but some highlights, some really important areas that we saw decreases are aggravated assaults, which are assaults with weapons or with serious bodily injury. We saw a significant decrease there. We had 210 of those incidents in 2016. Compared to our all-time high in 2013 was 300. So In 1 year, a 13% reduction. Also an important category, sexual assault. We had a slight decrease with a 5% reduction. And murder for 2016 was at a rate of 2 murders. And of course, any murders is too much for our community, but we were relieved that 2016 was way down compared to 2015. In 2015, we had a record 9 murders in Rapid City. And as you know, we're currently dealing with a string of homicides that have occurred here in the last 30 days or so in Rapid City.
Were there changes that were implemented after the 2015 numbers came out that you think are a direct had a direct impact on a reduction in areas in 2016?
Yeah, sure. In the last couple of years, we've stood up a specialized unit. It's essentially a task force. It's called our Street Crimes Unit. And at one point in time, we were working primarily in the downtown area and the bike path area, trying to really reduce some of the serious violent crime that was occurring within that area and with our homeless population. And in 2013, we had an alarming 300 aggravated assaults. And comparatively, at that time, Sioux Falls had less than we had, even though they have about double of the population. So we decided to target our highest need for police services neighborhoods over the past year, which primarily was in our residential areas of North Rapid City. And that specialized unit worked primarily evening hours. And really what they were going after was they were going after known drug users in our community. And they were doing things that that requires a lot of extra time. They were conducting surveillance. They were utilizing intelligence to be in the right place at the right time, and also targeting people that, based on previous behavior, we knew were at a higher risk for aggravated assault. So our theory is if we could make contact with them and make an arrest earlier in the evening, whether it be a drug arrest or an alcohol violation or something on a lower level, we might be able to bring down the violent incident from occurring. So I think that theory has paid off well for us, and I think that we've really made an impact there in our higher need for service neighborhoods.
So because of that, did you see an increase or an uptick in other arrests, in a drug-related arrest or alcohol-related arrests?
Well, I will just tell you that our drug arrests for 2016, we made a total of 1,280 drug arrests, which is slightly down from the previous year. In 2015, we had a record high number of drug arrests that we've ever experienced in our city at 1,349. And keep in mind that these numbers are more than double of what our drug arrests were just 5 years ago. So that's important to us because as we're working very hard to combat violent crime, we know that most or all of our violent crime has a direct connection in one way or another to illegal drug use. And of course, in Rapid City, and I think throughout South Dakota, that illegal drug use over the last few years has been methamphetamine. And that's just been devastating for our community and other communities around us.
So most or all of violent crime has a direct connection to illegal drug use. How do you know that? Is that what you see on the street every day? Is that statistical information?
It is both. And I can tell you that each time that we have a major event like a homicide that occurs, as we evaluate, you know, those incidents, we always are looking at what could we have done as a community to prevent that? How could we have intervened at a lower level before it escalated to this level? And I'll just tell you that just by reviewing our homicides that we've had over the last couple of years, almost all of them have a connection in one way or another to illegal drug use or methamphetamine. Another really high-risk area for law enforcement is our officer-involved shootings. And I can tell you that since I became chief in summer of 2014, we've unfortunately had four officer-involved shootings. And with each of those, we brought in the Division of Criminal Investigation. They handled an independent investigation. And through that process, three out of the four officer-involved shootings that we had, the suspects in those cases were connected with the methamphetamine use or distribution. So very clearly, when there is violence present, there is currently oftentimes methamphetamine involved.
So let's talk about officer safety for a moment. What sorts of policies or even policies you implement or conversations you have with officers on the street to sort of deal with the increase, violence connected with meth trafficking and what those officers are going to face on a daily basis?
Well, that's a very interesting area to talk about. I will tell you that over the last year, with the increases in ambush situations against law enforcement, throughout the United States. This is one of the things that we are talking about very frequently within our department. And our training is designed so that, you know, as a new officer, you go through a very thorough introductory training through the Police Academy and PEER. But we have ongoing in-service training, and each of our officers receives about 80 hours of advanced training each calendar year. So throughout that advanced training, we have things like firearms training, use of force training. We also have training on how to effectively intervene with mentally ill persons called our crisis intervention training. But I will tell you, our officers are paying very close attention to their safety. And as far as equipment and such goes, we as a department, we have done several things to provide the best level of protection to our officers. Shortly after the Dallas situation, where the five officers were ambushed in one incident, we were able to secure additional level of a bulletproof vest that will possibly stop a rifle round. And that's not something that you can wear on a daily basis for your entire 40-hour work week, but we have equipped all of our patrol vehicles with those items. We also are currently working on a project to reinforce security within our patrol cars and using Kevlar to do so. And without going into the specific details to expose our security, I will just tell you that we are taking officer safety very serious. We are doing everything that we can to be prepared for the worst, but we're hoping for the best. But I'll tell you, we are definitely focused in our training.
Let me ask you this. As we see increase in ambush situations nationwide, have officers in Rapid City been subjected to harassment, being followed home, some of the things that you read about in other cities? Is that something that's happening here in South Dakota, in your city?
More so, we have seen just a high level of support from our community to encourage us to stay safe, but continue to be the force that stands between good and evil in our community. So I just want to say that I am just very thankful for the Rapid City community and the support that they have shown for our officers. That has been priceless as we work to continue to serve the community in even more challenging times. But also, we need to retain the current staff that we have, and we need to continue to recruit new officers. Couple things on the officer recruitment is, I'll tell you, the Monday following the tragedy in Dallas, we had a class of eight new officers that were starting. They were reporting for duty on their first day as a police officer. And a lot of these young people, you know, they put a lot of time and effort and several years of education and relevant work experience to attain this awesome goal of becoming a police officer for our community. And the situation in Dallas, I know it shuddered everybody's soul. And, you know, it just made you, it made me concerned. Are these new officers going to show up for duty on Monday morning? And I'll tell you, that class of officers is one of the strongest, most cohesive classes that we've had in a long time. They have already returned from the academy. They are currently in their field training, so they are out on the streets serving the community with a training officer at their side. But I think the reason why they're motivated to continue to serve this community is because of the community support that they received. I'll also tell you that just coincidentally this morning, we brought on 9 new police officers. This is a process that took several months to accomplish as far as recruitment and testing and the process of hiring new people. But I had the great privilege as a police chief, and this is one of the greatest parts of my job, is to welcome new people to their career in law enforcement. So that's how I started my day today at 8 o'clock. 9 new Rapid City police officers. They will be sworn in on Wednesday afternoon, and they will be going through a rigorous training schedule. Most of them will be going off to the Police Academy and PEER for several months, and then they'll be returning by this summer for their field training so that they can continue to serve our community.
Carl Jagras is Chief of Police for the Rapid City Police Department. Chief Jegeris, we hope you'll come back and talk with us more in the future.
Thank you.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Today is the 100th anniversary of what has long been thought to be the day the very first jazz record was made. I spoke with SDPB Jazz Nightly host Carl Gerke for this story.
Well, this is the 100th anniversary of the recording of the very first jazz recording by a group called the Original Dixieland Jazz Band. And these were a group of musicians, white musicians from New Orleans who came to Chicago. There were a lot of New Orleans musicians who came up to Chicago around 1914, 15, 16. And the Original Dixieland Jazz Band got together in Chicago playing this music, which was unknown elsewhere in the country and the world. But there were people who were coming through Chicago and going back to New York who heard the Original Dixieland Jazz Band and some of the other bands, and they said, you got to book these guys in New York. They're great. And among the people that came through, Al Jolson, he got someone to book them in a club in New York City in January of 1917. And the crowds at first didn't know what to make of this music because they'd never heard anything like it before. This was loud, raucous music, frenetic. And it was just crazy because no one had ever heard anything like it before. It was sort of a challenge to the established, more polite dance music. But there was a lot of publicity about this band coming to New York City. So the Columbia Graphophone Company booked them to make some records on January 30th, 1917. So they played Indiana and another tune that was popular the day, Darktown Starter's Ball. And so they recorded these sides. And then they played them for the Columbia record executives, and they said, no way are we releasing this music.
Huh. So it starts out, they make up this music themselves in New Orleans. This is where it comes from?
Essentially, yeah. That's where jazz came from. And the lineup of the band, a lot of New Orleans bands, you had a cornet or trumpet, clarinet, trombone, piano, and drums.
It sounds, when you listen to it, it sounds tame.
It sounds tame.
By today's standards.
It sounds tame to today's ears.
Yeah.
But you got to imagine hearing this for the first time. You had this, like I mentioned, this is loud music. And, you know, to virgin ears, this was revolutionary. This is just outrageous music. And, you know, because you had trombones blaring and the cornet playing this crazy music, and sometimes they made sounds of barnyard animals. It was almost sort of a novelty at the time, particularly when it was played by some of these bands like the Original Dixieland Jazz Band.
Record executives hate it.
The Columbia hated it, and so they said, we're not putting that record out. And so about a month went by, and another record company, the Victor Talking Machine Company, said, well, we'll record them, because by then, the Original Dixieland Jazz Band, you know, they were the thing in New York City. Everyone wanted to hear them. So Victor recorded them and recorded the Original Dixieland One Step and Livery Stable Blues. And this was a big hit record. This was the record that introduced jazz to the world. Not just something for people in Chicago and New Orleans or those that were fortunate to hear the band in New York City. Now it went worldwide across the nation, and this launched jazz. And so what happened then was that Columbia thought, oh, maybe we should release that record after all. So then they went back and got that original record that they put out, that they recorded on January 30th, 1917. Then they released it because the other record was such a big hit.
Thank you.
there were other bands who were offered the opportunity to make records, but they didn't want to do that because one thing is they thought then people were going to steal their music or steal what they were doing. But the cornet player in the band, a guy by the name of Nick LaRocca, saw the publicity value of recording this music. So he said, yeah, we're going to make a record.
Yeah. How do you describe Dixieland then?
Well, the music...
This early Dixieland, right?
Yeah, this early jazz. And, you know, we think of jazz as improvisation. But this band, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, everything was planned out.
Okay.
They weren't improvising. And they had their established routines. And what's interesting is, as part of the publicity and the marketing of the band, was they said, oh, we don't even know how to play our instruments. We don't know how to read music. And we're just making it up on the spot. And that was all part of the, you know, the publicity and kind of the mystique of the music. And one of the members of the band joked that, oh, I don't know how many pianists we had to audition before we found one who didn't know how to read music. But most of the guys could read music, although Nick LaRocca, the cornet player, sort of the leader of the band, couldn't read music, but yet everything was still planned out.
Yeah.
And
This changes everything. What's the legacy of this?
This changes everything because now everyone hears this music, as I mentioned. It goes worldwide. And then other record companies start recording other bands, both black and white bands. And then people who buy, young musicians who buy these records, they're inspired to play music, like Benny Goodman, for example. So you have other people that are coming along. So this, it just kind of grows from there.
100 years is not that long.
Doesn't seem like it was that long ago.
Compared to classical tradition.
But this was music that celebrated freedom. This was music that was American. And that was one of the great things about this was that before that, we talk about the music that came before, a lot of polite dance music. We talk about dance music, kind of more polite, sort of from more of the European traditions with violins and strings. But here you have this music that is American. It's lively. And again, we're also right at, you know, 1917, World War I. America's about to get involved in World War I, so you have that whole aspect of what's going on. So this changes everything, changes the course of music, and we're you know, even though the original Dixieland Jazz Band isn't considered really truly authentic, this was the band that gets the credit for really starting the whole thing as far as getting the world and America familiar with this music, getting this music known, that these crazy sounds are out
and
there.
And then we export it to the world.
Export it to the world, and now it's the world's music. But the interesting thing, there's a sort of a footnote here. Mm. January 30th may not have been the day that record that we're talking about of Indiana was actually recorded.
Mm-hmm.
There was a discographer from London by the name of Brian Rust who's done a lot of research into early jazz records, and he examined the Columbia record files, and there was nothing for January 30th with the original Dixieland Jazz Band, but there was on May 31st. So was January 30th the day of the first jazz record? Probably not, but according to legend, that is the day that is considered the recording of the first jazz record. However, the other record we were talking about for Victor, that was the first record that was released. So whether
on what day?
I think it was released in March of 1917. It was recorded in February 1917. But that was the record that was sold thousands. Some even said a million copies. It was a big hit. It was an amazing story about the original Dixieland Jazz Band.
Now you're going to be here tonight, live with the JAS Quintet.
The JAS Quintet. It's just coincidence that happens to be on this anniversary. But we've invited the JAS Quintet from Sioux Falls. They've got a new album out. It's called Leap Year Baby. Actually, it's not out just yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming out soon. But they're going to be previewing some songs from the new album. And they'll be here. They'll be playing live here at the New Hearth Center. Will be downstairs in the Freedom Forum.
Okay.
And it's open, so anyone can come by, sit, and listen. And the band would love it. The more people there, the better.
And you'll be there hosting.
I'll be there hosting. We may have some surprises, but it'll be a lot of fun. So 8 o'clock, come on by for some live jazz.
Always surprises at a jazz concert.
Always surprises. I mean, that's jazz, the sound of surprise.
Radio. This week, for our Images of the Past feature, we're talking with Richard Carlson. He's a former Rapid City Journal photographer, and he's tasked with archiving a massive collection of historic photos. We're reaching him via phone from Deadwood. Richard Carlson, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me today.
I should tell folks that they can see Dakota Life this Thursday night. That's February 2nd, 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain, for a television feature of this collection. And you're with us here now on the radio to talk about it. So tell us, what are we overall talking about? 800,000 photos. Where do they come from?
Well, real quick, I'll make a correction. I was a photographer at the Aberdeen American News and also at the Artist Leader.
I'm sorry.
The Rapid City Journal. That's okay. It's a small state. We all kind of know each other. this collection came from, the works of a father and son photographers that had studios in the Black Hills, northern Black Hills, starting in about the 1920s all the way up to about 1990. And I would say that the Joseph Fassbender, the father, actually started his photography career up in the Faith area. So he was up in the ranch country of South Dakota before he came to the Black Hills and started working with another photographer. If we were to fast forward to the time when the son has passed away and these photos are all kind of just boxed up and stored, three communities of Lead, Deadwood, and Spearfish got together and purchased all of these photos so that they could be kept in the area and maybe begin the process of conservation. And so now they've all been moved to the Homestake Adams Research and Cultural Center in Deadwood, where they're in a better storage condition. And we're working every week to catalog and sometimes digitize the images.
How have they been preserved? Well preserved, or are you seeing some damages from storage over the past?
You know, there's a lot of stuff that's in really, really good shape. I mean, there are stacks and stacks of prints, some of them quite large, 16 by 20, that are in real, real good shape. The negatives, for the most part, look pretty good. Although, as you can imagine, the older stuff, and in particular the stuff that's on glass, we're finding quite a few that are damaged there, and I think, you know, some of those are certainly it's going to be possible to get them digitized and kind of get them preserved that way. And even if there's some damage that we sort of need to fix a little bit later, of course, these days that's a little easier to do on the computer than trying to kind of repair it on the front end. And we want to try to handle it as little as possible, of course.
So this is a history of South Dakota. In some ways, it's also a history of photography when you talk about glass plate photography and then negatives. Are you sort of familiar with how that looks and are watching it in front of you as you examine individual prints and photos?
Sure. I did spend 20 years as a full-time photojournalist in the state myself, and I feel like I was kind of in that business during kind of a good time to be experiencing photography as I migrated from, a dozen or so years of using a darkroom into the digital age. And I started using digital in 1997 or so still use it, every day, of course. But it's fun to get back to looking at film and have, you know, kind of a greater appreciation for what it took to kind of make those pictures happen. And I know that when I give a class, I really kind of come at it, even though I might give a class talking about digital cameras, I sort of come at it from the angle that, if you are shooting film, you have to kind of be sort of disciplined and very purposeful in how you take your pictures, and that sort of pays off later when you don't have to fix those things on the computer, and I hope that kind of comes through.
Do you notice a difference in the quality?
If you mean quality from then,
yeah, the quality of images. Yeah, when we were capturing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that there's a difference in the quality. I wouldn't say that one's necessarily better or than the other. The analog quality that film has, I think, is something that people that are into music kind of speak of as well, in terms of the audio qualities of a pre-digital recording. There's just a different kind of feel and sound to it. I think the same thing applies to photography. It's hard to imagine better images than what we see these days with very, very high resolution digital cameras. I mean, I know that, for me personally, it's been fantastic. And obviously, it's easier to make deadlines with those kinds of things and have a lot higher quality than what I used to be able to do years ago. Mm. But again, those large negatives have such a, the film has such a great kind of different quality to it, that it's when you think back 100 years or so and you see a large panoramic image and you think to yourself how fantastic the detail is and whatnot, it really makes you, it kind of puts you in awe of how that was pulled off so long ago.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment. Our guest is archivist and photographer Richard Carlson. We're talking about the Fassbender? How do I say that, Richard?
Yeah, Fassbender.
Yep. Fassbender collection. And you can tune in to Dakota Life this Thursday, February 2nd, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain on SDPB TV to see a story that features this collection. Right now, we're talking with Richard Carlson on In the Moment with South Dakota Public Radio. And Richard, I'm wondering, 800,000 photos or more, or roughly, what do they depict? What's in the pictures?
Well, I mean, most of us kind of have the feeling that, probably 80 to 90% of the collection is what you might expect from a studio. It's a lot of class pictures, senior pictures, or school pictures, I guess I should say, and weddings, and maybe pictures of, business people and businesses and those kinds of nuts and bolts kinds of images. And the rest would be the other stuff that probably has a greater public interest, and those are, events and things that were going on at the time. So, most of it being the portraits. It's a busy time kind of cataloging all of that, and we certainly think that that will have, some value to genealogists and whatnot in the future, and there might be a way for us to have those names be searchable and have those images be available to someone who's looking for, their great grandparent or somebody that might have graduated from Deadwood High School in 1940 or something. Huh. And then the rest, like I said, are more the events and that sort of thing. There's construction at Mount Rushmore and the Stratosphere balloon launch, things like that.
Tell me what the archival process is like. How do you approach a task such as this?
Well, I mean, it's sort of a game of inches, I guess. I mean, you just realize that you just take it one box at a time and just kind of get to work. And basically what happens every week here is I will work with volunteers one or two days a week. And we'll take a box of these old negatives that are in the old, musty, dusty envelopes and remove the negatives, and sometimes there's small prints in these envelopes as well. And we just basically repackage everything. We put it into a new acid-free envelope that's going to help it to last longer. And then we put, all of those repackaged envelopes inside of a new acid-free box. And so basically it's just kind of repackaging everything. And while we're at it, then, of course, we're writing a number down. And most of these do have names on them, so we can write the name on the envelope and on the new envelope. And when we finish a box, we put all that information into a database and put the box up on the shelf. And that enables us to, put our hands on that negative really within less than a minute. If someone's looking for a certain name, we can just pull it right off the shelf and pull it right out and kind of go from there if it needs to be digitized. We're not digitizing those photos on the fly because that would take far too much time. But we do try to digitize things that we think are a little more interesting, some of those events and whatnot that I mentioned earlier.
So what gets you sort of excited when you open up an envelope or a box? What constitutes for you a treasure that you're going to say, wow, as you discover it for the first time?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things here. And I'm mentioning these events as being kind of the images that have a broader public interest, but occasionally you'll come across a portrait, and I know this happens, and sometimes it's just me standing back and watching the volunteers and kind of listening to them chat, because they may be looking at photos of their classmates from the class of 1960 or something like that. And so sometimes just listening to the chatter of the volunteers as they go through those portraits is a lot of fun. But if you have other images that are not portraits, some images kind of stand on their own as a just an interesting image to look at. But other images might have content that makes you wonder what's going on in the photo, so that it gets you going on trying to find out what's happening in the image, and whether it's a parade or something that looks like it might have been a crime scene or. And other than the obvious stuff, like I mentioned before, Mount Rushmore, that sort of thing.
Richard Carlson is an archivist and a photographer. He is joining us for Images of the Past this week as we talk about the Fassbender collection. He's working on archiving 800,000 photographs taken by a father and son studio over from the 1920s to the 1990s. And you can see Dakota Life feature that on SDPB-TV Thursday night, February 2nd, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain. Richard Carlson, I understand you're calling us from inside a vault, so I want to say thanks for joining us there today from an unusual place.
Oh, no problem. You're very welcome.